which is in part because of a long history of suspicion about any of the biology from psychological sciences within childhood studies, and this separation that has existed between sociological and biological modes of understanding children. But also a sense in which I was assuming that by turning to the nanosciences that they would have some sort of answer that we as social scientists wouldn't have. You know, a charge of kind of false objectivity almost. But as I began to say, actually my experience has been rather different from that. Yes, the testing does enable us to witness some of these materials in ways that we cannot through social scientific techniques. Yes, they're sometimes reduced to numbers, but then when I sat down with them and we talked through, you know, where do some of these materials come from, they've got a lot of knowledge about where some of these materials come from, but we ended up looking on Wikipedia to see what, you know, they didn't know either. So there was this kind of moment of co-constructing these speculative stories about where these materials might have come from, because when you reduce some of these materials, like metals, to their trace elements, you cannot know for certain. Although, as I was saying, in the case of aluminium, we can be fairly sure about where they might have come from quite locally. And the same goes for the work that archaeologists of childhood are doing, and we've just been talking about this. Again, quite a lot of that work is speculative. They use osteoarchaeological analyses. They look at the materialities of objects in considerable detail, but they also piece together evidence about where children may or may not have been involved, where children, using archival material, where children may or may not have played, to get a sense of whether the objects that have been found are or are not toys. So it's these kinds of modes of speculation are, in other words, about these, you know, whether they're radical or not, I don't know, but these modes of interdisciplinarity and conversation, which then enable us to create these kinds of narratives. I'm midway through the project, so I'm a cop-out on what's next. But you're right, that thinking then about how do we then communicate has been something, not least in the school, that we've been trying to think about, so that we don't end up just then saying, well, here's all the information, we put it together, here's a learning pack which you can use, or here's some resources which you can use with children, which then reduce and efface that speculative element. So that's one set of possible responses, but I'd love to hear what others think.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I totally agree with what you noted. And there's a long history within science and technology studies of speculation, right? And it actually, like Latour, his book, and how he shows us that science in the laboratory is speculative. It all depends on what are the instruments that you're using to measure whatever you're going to measure, and what is your concept of what you're going to measure. So it has a very long tradition, perhaps not so much in education or in the social sciences, but yes, within scientists. And you know, your question, I'll just go somewhere else, about the role of the researcher and how we do not bring our own interpretations. And again, I think all research brings interpretations. There's not objectivity in any research. And one of the questions that I often get asked, because I do a lot of work with animals, children and wild animals, is, you know, what about your humanness within this research that wants to bring materiality, that wants to bring the more than human, the other? And I go to Anna Singh when she says, that's all we have, right? We are humans after all. So what is it that we can do within our human position that perhaps we're not even human anymore? We're not, but we are more than human already. But what is it that we can do to shift, to change the discussion, to pay attention to what else is taking place around us? How can we decenter? And perhaps it's with imagination and speculation that we can decenter the human.
I think one of the tricks, the trickiness that I experience, because I work with teachers and young children, is teachers resisting the notion of decentering the child, because then they kind of don't see what their role is. And that's a really tricky one to work with them. So in fact, in one of the projects I'm doing right now around waste, some of the teachers are extremely resistant. The child keeps coming back, and I keep bringing waste to the foreground. And I think it's something, I think I have a responsibility to stay with that and not, and it's hard because it's so easy to go back to the child.
Mm-hmm. And I want to add something to sort of clarify maybe my presentation a little bit. All the photos that you saw were not my pictures. I didn't take any of these pictures that you saw. They were the children that took the pictures. So they sort of engaged with the manholes. They took the pictures of the manholes, and they were their practices of surveying, like listening to the sounds. And they took the photos of that, the debris pool. And they took the photo of, no, actually the photo and the picture is actually from the municipality of the water ponds. Because I couldn't get access to because there's no photos, they're just films of the water ponds. So that sort of maybe clarifies that that's a child that's been taking the photos. But I cannot say that they learned something from the study, but I know what I learned and what the engineers sort of learned and what they take bring with them.
Yes. Please.
Could you say more about what the engineers learned and what they shared with you about the experience and what they came away with?
Yeah, we had a meeting for 2 hours, and for 1 hour they sort of had to talk themselves through the fact that they were so there was so much anxiety involved with this meeting with so young children, because they knew some of the children just turned 3. And some of them were turning 6. How do you meet a group of children, just a small group of 5 to 7 children in each group, but how do you meet them? And how do you actually start to listen to them? And then the children in this project, they didn't have any problems with engineers coming in because they were accustomed to me. I was doing research. There was another one coming and doing research with me. That was not a problem. But for the engineers, it was really, how do you interact with so young children? And they had to talk about this anxiety and that they were scared of losing control. And that was the biggest issue, to lose control. And I said, control is not a problem. It's not a problem to lose control.
I want to ask you about the losing control bit. And does that link to our earlier session when we were hearing about young people as climate activists who almost are starting to wrestle the control about the political sphere away from some of the politicians? Was it almost similar? The engineers are worried about losing some... Was it losing control of the children or losing control of the kind of the knowledge that they were sharing?
I think it was like double. It was all of a sudden they had to get in tune to the children and try to listen to what was happening, because there was happening in a lot of things. Like, think about five individuals, they're all 3 years old, and they sort of go on a treasure hunt. They sort of run all over the place, and they were sort of trying to following, and like they. In the end, they were moving differently. They were sort of, they didn't have a problem with that. The children were 100 meters in front of them, or they were jumping on the manhole that they found, or listening and taking photos. Like, I have really, really long photo sessions of looking at dripping water and listening to dripping water. But also to, all of a sudden, their methods were questions. How they surveying? Like the children said, there's not, this manhole is not, is disconnected, it doesn't fill any purpose, why is it here? Or who moved it? And all those questions that they sort of spontaneously asked, and they needed to deliver, the engineers. And I think that was a problem also, to deliver.
Can I just add on this point about being out of control? I find the notion of thinking about things being out of control really helpful, actually. Both in terms of whether there are, in a somewhat paradoxical sense, methods that can somehow be out of control, i.e. out of the control of researchers and dominant experts, but also out of the control of humans. but also in a sense which might work in parallel or in synthesis with the sense in which in the Anthropocene, we as humans are out of control, even though it's the Anthropocene is ostensibly something of our own making. But then as Jane Bennett kind of argues at the end of her book on vibrant matter, surely that's still a case for thinking about where we as humans should try to draw back some kind of control and seek to intervene at certain moments.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of being out of control is helpful, I think, but also comes with it another ethical and political responsibility.
Yeah. But as sort of was out of their like their profession, because they were water engineers, and they knew exactly what they were supposed to do, so they were really out of control.
Just before we go to the next question, I just want to ask a question on the back of what you said, Helen. So when I was listening, you know, you become very aware of the nuances of your different perspectives, and you see them often at the same time. So there might be post-colonial feminist collective versus personalised resilience. And I just wanted to ask, and it's sort of on the back of Peter's question, what role, so it's a three-part question. Do you feel and each question gets worse, by the way. So the first question is, do you feel the clock ticking existentially in relation to the areas that you're talking about? And then the second question is, does that affect in any way your work and the temporal way in which you conduct your work? And then the third question is, that in a time when we're more aware than ever of differences, and that politically we see quite vast divisions throughout society, what role do you see for scholars in trying to work towards a common language to talk about the challenges that you're doing, that you're addressing? So, three-part question.
That's a good question, but it's hard.
Well, that's why I asked.
I've got to think through that.
All right, I'll give you 5 minutes. There you go. You had a question,
sir.
She's ready.
Talking.
Okay.
About it. I mean, I don't have an answer, but I can talk.
I think it's a good question, right? What's our role?
I actually think that it is, the clock is ticking.
Yeah.
And I think that we, for the research that we do collectively, is about finding other ways of thinking. And particularly when we are in education, we have the privilege to be in education that has actually created this epistemological and in the previous conversation ontological perspective that is so destructive, because the Anthropocene, like Peter just said, is our own making. So why continue to use the same kind of tools that created the problems that we created through the Anthropocene? So it is a wake-up call. In a way, I want to think about the the Anthropocene, but I don't want to perpetuate the Anthropocene. Mm. That's why is that idea that, you know, does it affect our way of thinking and doing things? Yes, absolutely. I think it has to affect our way of thinking. So how do we work with the Anthropocene in terms of the tensions that the Anthropocene gives us? I don't want to take it on and use it, but I want to work with the tensions that the Anthropocene is giving us.
Fascinating.
I have one other response, and at least a couple of people here have heard me say this before, but I'm unsure about the notion of slow scholarship, not because I'm unsure about its feminist underpinnings or the ways in which it pushes back against neoliberal regimes of speed in the academy, but to give an example, I did a project nearly 20 years ago, which for a number of reasons was very complex politically and ethically, which I won't go into. It took us 10 years to write about that project and to find some kind of response. Meanwhile, the young people in different groups, different ethnicities, where there were kind of elements of racism and environmental racism involved, were having to deal with all the issues they were dealing with for that entire 10 years and much longer, whereas we, sitting with our privilege in university, were spending all this time just thinking and mulling things over and so on. And you know, we've written about this and it's intensely problematic. So I think perhaps we need to rethink the temporalities of scholarship. And there have been plenty of critiques of slow scholarship, of course, but in this particular moment, and given, as you say, Veronica, the clock is ticking, to think again about our role as researchers and the time that we take over things. that doesn't necessarily mean that we shouldn't be careful and reflective, but I think there's a whole bunch of things that we need to think about further there.
Yeah, I think I agree. Any other thoughts? Any thoughts from you?
I think that's getting back to some of the stuff I was thinking about in terms of responsibilities here, in terms of what it is that we do and our privilege and the spaces in which we can work. And again, that picking up on what you say, it's not just about time, it's about mode and form. And you know, the mode and form of the learner journal and the book, and that may be not quite the best way to deal with some of this stuff in terms of the clock ticking. And again, I think part of what we've been talking about in getting to this point today and tomorrow is modes and forms and temporality and stuff. And we are in a privileged position to fundamentally rethink how it is that we do what it is that we do when we work. This is work for us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a set of work practices that give us opportunities to do stuff, which is picking up on the point you've already made. How do we do stuff in the moment we find ourselves, in the time we find ourselves? It's a real challenge.
It was fascinating. You had fascinating contributions, and it was very sensitive to listening to them. And some of you have very strong emancipatory interest and rhetorics, and you ask political questions too. How aware are you about those dangers which we have when we are acting like Leninist avant-garde or knowing better things than ordinary people? And you are speaking in avant-gardist rhetorics. For example, just Habermas, Jürgen Habermas, who is the father of this theory on knowledge interests. Maybe you are aware about it. But there is another side in the emancipatory interest too, the power aspect. That if I know better than you. And you are hearing me, if I'm a Freudian or feminist or Marxian, I know better. You are dependent. And you know Freudian theory that it takes 10 years for you to emancipate me if there's a process. There's a dependent power relation. And we are using power now because we are elitists. We know better than ordinary people. And the clock is ticking. And we are in a hurry. And we are not always reflecting what are we saying, because we are fighting. Are you aware about these problems? Because your methods is imagination, radical pedagogian, feminist, analytical tools, and so on. Especially because we are speaking on climate change, anthropocene, there are mental counter-reactions, illnesses, addictive populist reactions, very hard. I'm afraid sometimes. Very hard questions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't think that I have emancipatory interest. I actually think that there's no way out of where we are. I think that what we are trying to think is about how do we live in this space that we have here in front of us. And certainly, you know, unlike Marx and Marxism, I don't have an ideal. I really don't know. I think the work that we're doing is trying to experiment and speculate as to what are the possibilities, not necessarily that I already know what the answers are, and how do we live with the incommensurabilities that we have in front of us. Mm-hmm. It's dangerous, yes, absolutely. Everything is risky because there are possibilities, there are things that open up, and at the same time, there are a lot of risks and a lot of dangers. Yeah, absolutely.
Any other thoughts?
I thought about this with emancipatory. When it comes to environmental education, in a sense that I would argue that it's maybe more emancipating because we're sort of providing the child the right answers.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've tried to do in my research with these very young children is not to implement my knowledge on them. It's sort of in a discussion where their questions to them, to water and with water, are the driving force for this sort of this research project. So if the children start to talk about pollution, that's something I can start, we can continue and sort of investigate and experiment on together. And one of the biggest questions in my research has been, how do you clean water? And that came out of one child's, or a couple of children's experience of being in parts of the world where there's water scarcity, and that they had experienced what happens if you drink dirty water. So that was sort of the main... the question that sort of mattered to all the children all of a sudden. If I had told the same thing, like if you get ill when you drink dirty water, I don't think the research process would have been the same way. So in a sense, what they're doing is emancipating themselves in that sense. I'm not emancipating them because they get knowledge, because I'm not implementing knowledge on them. So they sort of inform me with knowledge together with other children.
I think it's also worth noting that in the field of early childhood education, at least in Australia, it's very, very conservative, and it is risky doing this kind of work, and most people don't want to do it because it takes time. Not so much slowing down, but it takes time to get access, it takes time to build relationships with communities. Like, and it just seems to be even more difficult with the very young child, with all of the ethics, the formal universalistic sort of ethics procedures that we have to go through. But it is risky, and it's usually work that people don't want to do. And I think that those power relations are really important, and I think that power is part of that. Doing early childhood research is not sexy. It's not trendy. It's like not where you want to be, usually, in the academia.
No, that's true.
World.
Definitely.
Or children's geography.
Why do research with a 3-year-old?
That's or babies.
And babies, yeah.
I think underpinning my work has always been the question of what are the alternatives? If we want to see them as alternatives, and if we want to contrast alternatives and mainstreams. Not necessarily in a utopian sense, but I do a lot of work away from this project. I've done it for the last 20 years with people who create what they call alternative education spaces, a whole range of different ways of doing education. So I see myself as kind of part of, but also a critic of those kinds of movements. It's not just me as the researcher doing this or trying to do emancipation. There's a whole suite of people all over the world, and certainly my work all over the UK, experimenting with different ways of creating alternatives. And again, working in a secondary school in the UK, trying to do this kind of work is very difficult, because to find space, even with the younger group of 11 to 15-year-olds who are not yet doing exams, is incredibly difficult. So again, it's a question of, you know, what is the kind of alternative within that space rather than outside of that space that might be possible. And that was we did four months in the school, but it took us 12 months to get to the stage to actually start the work, because we had to work with the teachers, with the rest of the school, with our ethics committees. A whole range of actors were involved in this process, which, as I said, I don't see it necessarily as emancipatory, and maybe there should be that element, but it's this element of experimentation, asking what is the alternative that detains me, but detains a vast range of other people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Really, really, really interesting. So I think that's a good point at which to wrap up this particular session. Steve's got something.
I just think that's a really interesting thing to take forward into the next sessions, is what sort of work do we want to do? What sort of workers do we want to be?
Mm-hmm.
And who do we want to work with? You know, they're really cool questions to think about. Without imagining that we're in the avant-garde or we're in Victoria or anything, but we are doing something to So what do we want to do? And again, I think we need these three elements of doing affect and ethics are really important and a really interesting way to think about what it is that we want to do when we do the work that we do.
Especially if it's in the moment and you can't plan it.
No.
You know, that's some of those risks that we have with the sort of...
But what we take into that moment is really...
Absolutely, really absolutely. And I think for me, it's about those moments, then that's what I want to